at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It was called the Great War, and even the war to end all wars. But today, says our guest, World War I has become a forgotten war, overlooked, underappreciated, and outshone in popular imagination by the even bigger conflict that came soon after, World War II. We're talking this hour with Richard Rubin, longtime writer and author of the new book, The Last of the Doughboys. Rubin tells this war story through the tales of the aged veterans who fought in its muddy trenches. Rubin says he wrote this book just in time. He began interviewing World War I vets 10 years ago, all centenarians up to age 113. He found people like J. Lawrence Moffett from Cape Cod, whose Yankee division ran afoul of U.S. Army rules but was beloved by the French. Also, Moses Hardy of Aberdeen, Mississippi, one of more than 300,000 African-American soldiers who served. And the last of the last, Frank Buckles of Missouri, whose death 2 years ago was noted nationally as it marked the end of the World War I veterans' generation. Today in The Exchange, we meet the last of the Doughboys through this new book by Richard Rubin, and let's hear from you. Do you have a connection to World War I through a relative or a friend? What do you remember about the stories they told? Also, if you just have questions or comments about this conflict, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Richard Rubin joins us from a studio at Maine Public Radio. And Richard, it's great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's pick up on that idea, if we could, of World War I as the forgotten war. I'm quoting you there. You say, few things are as overlooked and underappreciated in the modern American landscape as World War I. How so, Richard?
Well, you know, if you go to any big box store, a big box bookstore, you'll find in the history section cases and cases of books about the Civil War and cases of books about World War II and maybe a shelf of books about World War I. And most of those are British. I walked around when I started this project and even well before that, and I noticed that everywhere there are monuments and memorials to the First World War in this country. It's very hard to find a town of any size that doesn't have one, even if they don't have something to the Civil War or World War II. And so it's really quite striking the difference between how fervently we once remembered World War I in this country and our role in it and to what extent we've largely forgotten it today. I can't tell you how many people have emailed me or come up to me after a speaking event and said, I didn't even know America was in World War I.
Really? Wow. Well, and you're right. There are little monuments in town squares all over New Hampshire. But you're also right. The bookstores don't reflect that, and certainly movies and pop culture don't reflect that. So why is this forgotten?
Well, as I said, you know, there are all those monuments. Those monuments were all built shortly after the war in the 1920s. And what happened was there were a couple of things. First of all, the war was terribly traumatic to Americans. We don't remember that today, but America didn't enter the war until April of 1917. So it had already been going on for 2.5 years. And our first combat deaths didn't happen until November of 1917. So there were really just 12 months of serious fighting for Americans in World War I. And yet in that time, America lost 117,000 men. And that was a terrible shock to this country, especially since, you know, World War I wasn't World War II. It didn't start because we were attacked by an enemy. The cause was more abstract in people's mind. It wasn't to get revenge on the Axis who had bombed the fleet at Pearl Harbor. It was to make the world safe for democracy. And if you've lost somebody in a cause like that, It can be very difficult for you. And at a certain point, America withdrew into itself. It stopped talking about that war. It stopped writing about that war. Histories kept coming to this country, English language histories, but they came from Britain. And the British were still very upset at America for not entering the war in 1914 when they did. So their histories of that era portray America's role in the war as being really minimal. They say Americans showed up late. They didn't make much of a contribution. And unfortunately, I think a lot of Americans internalized that and came to believe that they didn't play a significant role in the First World War, which nothing could be further from the truth. America played a tremendously significant role in World War I. And then you had the Great Depression and World War II, and World War I just kept getting pushed further back in our national memory.
Well, and talk a little bit more about what you said a minute ago, Richard. This idea of the way that we got into World War I, you're right, it wasn't as dramatic and clear-cut. So there was always this sense of, uncertainty about it, not feeling sort of great and proud and bold and sure.
You know, it's almost as dramatic the way we stayed out of the war for so long, because from the moment the war started in August of 1914, there was a lot of pressure from the international community, especially from Britain and France, for the United States to enter the war. We were a very large country and an industrial power. Our manpower and our industrial might could have been very useful, but President Wilson was adamant that the country stay out of the war. He said it had nothing to do with us, and he wasn't alone. That the war was there was a lot of sentiment in this country against entering the war. There were a lot of people who had no desire to go fight on behalf of Britain and France in defense of their empires. In fact, I come from New York originally, and the war was so unpopular in the city of New York that the mayor of New York, a man named John Paroi Mitchell, was voted out of office because he supported it.
Wow.
So there was a lot of pressure to keep us out of the war. But in fact, famously, President Wilson campaigned for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war," and was re-elected on that slogan. And then just 1 month after his re-inauguration in March of 1917, America was back in the war.
Well, and just remind us again real quickly, because I want to get to the stories of the Doughboys, but just remind us what it was that turned President Wilson and ultimately the country around.
Well, there were two things, really. The first was unrestricted submarine warfare on the part of the Germans. The British had the finest navy in the world at the time, and they had imposed a really devastating blockade, a naval blockade on Germany. And so while America was free to sell armaments and food and the like to anybody they wished, they really realistically could only sell them to the Allies because there was no way of getting them to the Germans. And so the Germans fought back the only way they could, which was with submarine warfare. And they sank British ships that had Americans on them. This raised tensions. They suspended the policy after the Lusitania for more than a year. But finally, things got so bad there that they had to start it again in January of 1917. And then they made a terrible blunder. They sent a telegram to the German ambassador in Mexico instructing him, knowing that America would probably get into the war because of unrestricted submarine warfare. They sent a telegram to the German ambassador in Mexico instructing him to approach the Mexican government and ask them to enter the war on the side of Germany. And when Germany won, they would give Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona back to Mexico. And when this was when this became known in the public, it was just the last straw.
Wow. Yeah, I read that in the book and I went, boy, I didn't remember learning that in school. So the focus has always been more on that submarine warfare and the Lusitania and so forth. And yet, you write, Richard, that even before President Wilson and the general public turned around, there were people, including some profiled in your book, who were, you know, gung-ho. They said, let's go to Europe and help our friends and allies out.
Absolutely, quite a lot of them. And some of them wrote very successful books. The most successful of all was written by a gentleman named Arthur Gallimpi, who is a kind of a career soldier who was working as a private detective in 1915 in New Jersey when the Lusitania was sunk. And he expected America to enter the war right away after that. And when it didn't, he became frustrated and sailed off for England on his own. and joined a unit of the Royal Fusiliers and saw a lot of action. He was very badly wounded, almost killed at the start of the Battle of the Somme in 1916, and came home and wrote a memoir called Over the Top, and published it right as America entered the war. Perfect timing. And it sold a million copies. It was without a doubt the most popular book of the war. And there were a lot of other people who did that too. Plenty of people sailed off. This was not allowed. So you had to – you were technically breaking the law to do this. But they sailed off to England or they snuck into Canada to join up and fight for the Allies.
Yeah, and there was one gentleman in your book who was with the Yankee Division. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't the Yankee Division kind of flout the rules a little bit in terms of when you could go over there and help out?
Well, that's a wonderful story. The Yankee Division was composed entirely of National Guard units from the six New England states. And its commander was a gentleman, Major General Clarence Ransom Edwards. And Edwards really wanted to get the Yankee Division over to France right away. But there were a couple of problems. One was that there were three regular army divisions, that is, they existed before the war, with seniority over his that could go over first. And the other was that he was a very abrasive man and very unpopular with a lot of other people in the army. So he couldn't get the orders to ship out for France. So he just shipped his entire division. We're talking 25,000 men and all their supplies and horses, shipped them over to France without orders.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, I cannot imagine how he engineered that. If you just think of how many ships are required to transport that many men and that much material over across an ocean without orders. And they arrived in France early in the fall of 1917, and they were greeted as saviors by the French because for a lot of French people, they were the first American troops they ever saw.
Well, and coming up after a short break, Richard, we'll dive into one of the doughboys that you interviewed in your book who served with this Yankee Division, J. Lawrence Moffett, one of your favorites, I think, from these interviews. We'll also take your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, Richard Rubin is here, author of the new book called The Last of the Doughboys, A History of America's Experience in World War I, as recalled by its last surviving veterans. We'll take your questions, comments, thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And you only have until this Saturday at noon to get in on the early bird drawing of NHPR's car raffle. So don't miss out on your chance to win $2,000 of gas gift cards from Irving Oil and help support NHPR at the same time. Go to NHPR.org to buy your raffle tickets or call 1-888-805-NHPR. We have a flash flood watch in effect through this evening for most of the state. Cloudy today, widespread showers and thunderstorms. Some may produce some heavy rainfall. Highs today, mid to upper 70s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the Executive MBA program at the University of New Hampshire, designed for working professionals accepting applications for fall. Details at mba.unh.edu. And the Mount Washington Auto Road, located on Route 16 in Pinkham Notch, where you can live free and drive to the world above treeline, online at mtwashingtonautoroad.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, The Last of the Doughboys. That's a new book by author Richard Rubin, introducing us to that generation which fought World War I. We'd love to hear from you this hour, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. If you have a personal connection to World War I through a friend or relative, what do you remember about their stories of this conflict? Also, if you just have questions or comments that you've always had about World War I, give us a call, the exchange number 1 800 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Richard, before we go to our listeners, just following up on this terrific story that you were telling before the break about the Yankee division that, as you told us, snuck over to serve in France, moving 20,000 men and materiel out of the country without orders. The U.S. Army was upset, but the French love these folks. And you interviewed somebody who served in that division, J. Lawrence Moffett. You also say that Mr. Moffett is responsible for making your book happen. Tell us a little bit more there.
Well, he was the first. I had a terrible time finding living World War I veterans when I first set out, and only found the first few with the help of the government of France, which shared a list of living American World War I veterans that it had. Nobody in America had such a list. J. Lawrence Moffett was the first person I actually connected with off that list. And he was 106 years old at the time. He wasn't the first veteran I interviewed. That was a gentleman named Anthony Piero, who I actually got to the day before I met J. Lawrence Moffett. And he had a very interesting story to tell, too. He was an Italian immigrant, came here in 1914, settled in Swampscott, Massachusetts, and was drafted. But that was a difficult interview for reasons that I won't get into here. It was a great interview in a lot of ways and fascinating, but it was a difficult conversation, and I was feeling very discouraged about the prospect of speaking to people that old and getting memories out of them. And the next day I went and visited with Mr. Moffett on Cape Cod, and his memory was just so sharp. He had such a remarkable memory for detail and could remember pretty much everything he had seen and done during the war, that those doubts just kind of evaporated in my mind. And from then on, I didn't have any anxiety at all about what it would be like to interview people like that.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about the whole process of interviewing centenarians. But one more question about J. Lawrence Moffett, because he's such a great figure. What did he say about his thoughts and his feelings on this idea of, you know, we're going to be the first to get over there, kind of doing it, flouting the rules, but we want so badly to help? That's the flip side of this isolationist coin that you talked about earlier.
Well, you know, everybody in that division, the Yankee division, were volunteers because they were all National Guard. And he had enlisted a couple of months before America entered the war because he saw what was coming. He left his job at an insurance company in Hartford to do so. And for the rest of his life, he was tremendously proud of his association with the Yankee division. For a long time, he had a YD license plate. And he saw more combat than anybody else I interviewed because they were the first division to go over in full, and he saw just about everything. But he was extremely stoic about all of it, and he was in harm's way for most of the time he was in France. But he told me several times in the course of interviewing him, just the first time, and I visited with him again a few months later, that nothing had ever been hard for him in his life. And just knowing what he had seen and done, that was a remarkable statement, but he really believed it. I asked him at one point if he'd ever been gassed. And, you know, if you know anything at all about World War I, you know about the use of poison gas and the terrible, terrible things it did to people. It could kill you in any number of gruesome ways. And I said, were you ever gassed? And he said, oh, sure. All the shells had gas in them practically. And I just looked at him for a moment kind of stunned. And I said, what was that like? And he just shrugged and he said, it wasn't too bad. I just lost my voice for a few days and eventually it would come back. I never went to medical for it. And that was really the kind of man he was. And frankly, that was really the kind of people that most of the people I interviewed were. They were just very stoic. Nothing was a big deal to them. They grew up expecting life to be hard. And when it was, they didn't complain. And if you want to know why World War I has largely been forgotten in this country, that's a part of the story, is that the men and women who fought in that war and served in that war didn't attract a lot of attention to themselves. And when another war came along and kind of pushed World War I to the rear, they didn't stand up and say, hey, remember us? They just faded into the background because that's the kind of people they were.
So that's part of the reason that it's forgotten. You talked about some of the other reasons before, but that's also part of it. It's this generation of, yeah, things are tough, and yeah, we did it, and yeah, let's move on.
Yeah, that's what they were like. They just were, you know, these were men and women who grew up without electricity. They grew up without automobiles. A great many of them grew up without running water. And they lost siblings at a very young age. A really startling number of the people I interviewed lost their fathers at a very young age before they themselves were 10 years old. And they just expected, as I said, that life would be hard. And when it was, and when they faced these hardships, you know, remember, a lot of things are said about the Greatest Generation because they grew up during the Depression and then went on to fight in World War II, which are remarkable accomplishments, and we all owe a great debt to them. But the World War I generation, as I call them, the Forgotten Generation, they fought a war and then had to deal with the Great Depression, and they're the ones who clothed and fed and housed the Greatest Generation during that Depression.
Under much duress, not only recovering from this war, but then facing the Depression as the adults, as the responsible ones.
Absolutely. And there was no safety net for them when they came back from the war. There was no GI Bill of Rights. A lot of them came back to find their businesses bankrupt, their farms gone to ruin, and they had to start all over again without any help from the government at all.
Wow. All right. Let's get our listeners involved in this conversation, Richard. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. The author is Richard Rubin. The book is called The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Bert joins us from Newcastle. Hi, Bert. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you. It's an interesting subject. It's good that people are finally paying attention to it just about 100 years later. My question is, I've been under the impression that before the U.S. got into the war, that both sides were getting really, really weary, and there was a good possibility of a negotiated settlement, which would have left the Germans somewhat in place. But then when the U.S. got in the war, that kind of did away with any possibility of a negotiated settlement and kept the war going for a long time, and then ended up causing the awful Versailles Treaty, which, of course, led to the Second World War.
Wow, Bert, great question. What do you think, Richard?
That is a great question. There were a lot of rumors throughout the war that there was going to be some sort of negotiated settlement. I mean, the war was terrible. Millions of men were being slaughtered over a few yards of land, and everybody wondered how much longer can this go on. But to my knowledge, and I've done an awful lot of reading on this subject and spoken to a lot of experts, there wasn't anything specific in the works shortly before America entered the war. And in fact, the war, as the end of the war happened, it happened very quickly. Germany launched a series of offensives in the spring and summer of 1918 to try and win the war quickly before America could arrive in force. But those gambles didn't pay off, due in large part to the American troops who were already there. And at that point, Germany was weakened so much that they were going to lose. It was just a matter of when. And even so, the war could have dragged on well into 1919 had it not been for the massive offensive the Americans launched at Meuse-Argonne in the fall of 1918, which ultimately ran right up until the very end of the war. That, by the way, the Battle of Meuse-Argonne remains to this day the deadliest battle in American history. Americans lost more than 26,000 men at that battle.
Wow, in one battle.
Mm-hmm.
Bert, thanks a lot for the question. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Richard, just picking up on something you said, you know, the terrible nature of this war. I mean, war is always terrible, but World War I seems to occupy a special place when you talk about the horrors of war. You mentioned millions of men slaughtered just to gain a few inches of land. Earlier, you mentioned, you know, being gassed, trenches, mud, bodies everywhere. Just put this into the context of sort of old warfare versus new warfare? Because you seem to be describing a war that, occupied ground on both types of war.
Well, it certainly did. And, you know, at the beginning of the war, a lot of people thought that cavalry was going to play an important part, which seems kind of amusing to us today from this perspective. But that's what people knew. They knew cavalry. You know, they knew infantry charges. What they didn't know yet were machine guns. And they didn't know barbed wire. And they didn't know trenches. And horses were completely helpless against these kinds of things.
Well, they're huge. They stick out like a sore thumb, you know.
Yeah, they're big targets. They don't do very well with big ditches or barbed wire. You know, their machine guns can kill them just as easily as they can kill men. And so it's interesting. When America entered the war, we had quite a few cavalry units too, and most of them were converted to artillery. Interesting fact, artillery killed more people in World War I than anything else. That played a very big role too. And of course, that's quite deadly to horses as well. America still used a lot of horses in that war. Anthony Piero, the first veteran I interviewed, worked with horses. He was in an artillery unit. And a horse actually saved his life once because a shell landed on the road ahead of him. And there was a horse walking in front of him, and the horse shielded him from the shrapnel of the shell. So it was killed, and it saved his life in the process. But, you know, that's a tale of warfare that happens all the time, that the tactics are not up to the weaponry, and that's what ends up killing an awful lot of people. But, you know, you mentioned things like trenches and poison gas. World War I was so horrible that all sides agreed mutually, basically, without even saying so, that they would never fight that kind of war again. And they never have. I mean, that's how horrible the war was.
Yeah, and I mean, war is always horrible again. But boy, reading your stories of some of these doughboys in those trenches, I mean, you almost can't read it because it's too awful. And the idea that you spend, you know, days in these trenches with all sorts of horrific things going on around you for the benefit of gaining, you know, a couple inches of land, I just wonder how these people didn't go crazy.
Well, I think unfortunately some of them did.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah, something I found in doing the research on this was that there were a lot of suicides of people returning from that war to this country. You know, PTSD certainly wasn't recognized back then. It was called shell shock and things like that. But there was no infrastructure in place to treat things like that here. And a lot of people came home and just suffered for the rest of their lives. And some of them decided to end their suffering. Several people that I write about in the book killed themselves. And, you know, even so, I think Americans had it better than some. The British executed people for what we now call PTSD. They called it cowardice, and they shot a lot of soldiers for that. Eventually they ended up apologizing to their survivors, but it wasn't until 2006.
Gee, yeah. And you write about that in the book, too, that people didn't take to soldiers being scared very lightly. The American army either. The British were more tough, as you said, but
yeah, Americans didn't execute people for that, but the British did execute quite a few.
Let's take another call, and this is Clara in Goffstown. Hi, Clara. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to share the story of my grandfather. He was in World War I.
Wow.
And I really didn't know anything about him. And it was interesting how your guest pointed out that we know very little about World War I. And even though my family, my grandfather was Polish, Poland was not a country at the beginning of World War I. And he was, my mother always said he was in the Russian army, so I had assumed that was true, and so did the rest of my family. Well, last year I met a Eastern European historian, and he looks at my grandfather's picture, and he said, "That's not a Russian uniform; it's a German uniform."
Wow!
So my grandfather was in the German army, and the uniform is definitely a German uniform. But by 1920, he's working for the Amersgate Corporation here in Manchester. And yet we know very little about him. And when you ask family members or even my cousins in Poland, they tell you they know even less than we do.
So, Clara, hold on. Let me make sure I got this right. So he served on the German side in World War
I. Apparently, he was conscripted. A lot of Poles were conscripted into the German army, the Austrian army, and some into the Russian army.
And then he came over here very shortly after the war and worked in the mills in Manchester.
Right, and I don't know why. Okay, why he picked Manchester, but there were a lot of Eastern Europeans coming to Manchester during that period of time to work for the corporation.
Well, Clara, thanks for calling in, and fascinating story. And there's a couple threads we could pick up on there, Richard. The role of immigrants, for example, in this war.
Yes, tremendously, tremendously important to the American Expeditionary Forces. Something like 20% of the army were composed of men who were not born in America. And among them, by the way, my grandfather, who came here from Russia in 1906 seeking freedom and a voice, was drafted in 1917 when he was 27 years old and served with the 77th Division, which was composed entirely of draftees from the city of New York. But yes, about 20% of the American Expeditionary Forces were foreign-born. And one of the really surprising things I learned in the course of researching this book, and three of the men I interviewed were foreign-born. There was Anthony Piero, who I mentioned earlier, the first veteran I interviewed, and two others from Poland, coincidentally. The War Department made great efforts to make immigrants feel welcome and valued in the American Expeditionary Forces. So they commissioned chaplains of a great many different religions. They promoted foreign-born men to officers as often as they could. They brought in foreign newspapers and ethnic food and things like that. Really, really surprising because immigrants were not being treated all that well in the rest of the country at the time. They were often isolated. They were mocked. It was very easy in those days to immigrate to America, but once you got here, there was tremendous pressure to assimilate as quickly as you could, to start speaking English, to shed your old name and adopt an American-sounding name. And so immigrants had a rough time of it out there often, but they were treated very, very well in the Army. That was a really surprising thing that I discovered.
Well, that's an all-out effort that you described by the War Department to solicit these folks. A couple years earlier, you said they weren't even allowed to enlist in the military.
That's right. Before the war, you had to be an American citizen to serve in the military. And one of the things the Army did was it provided a fast track to citizenship for immigrants, not as an incentive, I don't think, but really because they thought that people would fight harder for a country in which they were invested. It was really a very progressive, evolved notion.
All right. Well, more calls after a short break. Clara, thank you for that one. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. After a short break, more with Richard Rubin and the last of the Doughboys. Stay with us.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
Couldn't you use an extra $2,000 in your fuel budget? I'm Sam Evans-Brown. With just a few days left in NHPR's Early Bird Raffle, you're running out of time to pad your budget like that. $50 gets you a ticket, or $100 gets you three, and puts you in the running to win our Early Bird Prize, $2,000 in gas gift cards donated by Irving Oil. But we're pulling the winner's name on Saturday. Get your tickets by calling 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in New Hampshire, proud to support a broad range of nonprofits like Families First Health and Support Center. Details at familyfirstseacoast.org. And the Dairyfield School, a 6th to 12th grade day school, inspiring students to find their passion for academics, athletics, and the arts. Admission events all summer. Dairyfield.org/visit. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking with author Richard Rubin about the First World War through the stories of veterans who he interviewed. His book is called The Last of the Doughboys. You can join our conversation 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Richard, let's go right back to our listeners. And Nevin's waiting in Hancock. Hi, Nevin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is interesting. I'm going to have to buy this book. My grandfather was part of the Yankee Division, and was lucky enough, back in the late 70s, he didn't talk about it much, but we sat him down and put a microphone in his hand and taped some of his stories.
Oh, that's great, Nevin. Yeah.
The one I really liked, though, was he was part of that flotilla going over there, and halfway across the ocean, they went looking for ambulance drivers. And he had never driven a car before, but he had a friend who had. And somehow his friend taught him how to drive a car while they're on that ship. And they got over there and passed the test, and he was part of a big group that that drove ambulances and also used motorcycles with sidecars to pick up soldiers and bring them back. He didn't have any medical training, but he did learn how to drive, and there's great pictures of them lined up with their motorcycles and sidecars and ambulances, and it might have kept them alive, but he didn't talk too much about any of the horrors or anything like that, but he did have some great drinking songs. It sounds like on their breaks they spent a lot of time in the bistros and probably the brothels. I'm not sure. I didn't talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But he did have some great stories, though.
Wow.
And, he's also really proud of the big monument in Worcester, because I believe a great deal of Yankee Division came out of Worcester. And there's a big monument there that he was pretty impressed with. So.
Not a lot of combat stories, though, Nevin, huh?
No, he didn't want to talk about that much. Never said anything bad, but just said how he made good friends and really liked being in France.
Wow. Well, Nev, it's great to hear from somebody whose relative fought in that fabled Yankee Division. What do you think, Richard? What does this story from Nevin bring up for you?
Well, first of all, it's interesting that they I'd love to know how they taught him how to drive on a ship. That's fantastic. One of the veterans I interviewed, a fellow named Howard Ramsey, had worked as a taxi driver before the war. And when he was when he enlisted, they put him in something called the 302nd Water Tank Train. He drove a large water tank truck back and forth to the front. And one of the reasons they put him in there, he told me, was because there just weren't that many people back then who knew how to drive. And that kind of detail just reminded me how long ago this war was. 85 years is a statistic. But when you hear about all these horses at the front, and when you hear that there were very few people back then who knew how to drive before they went into the service, and even afterward, that really brings it home for you. The other thing is, his grandfather talking about drinking songs. The American Expeditionary Force, by and large, we talked a lot about how terrible the war was, but they were very high-spirited. They were very enthusiastic to be over there, even though the war was very controversial before America entered it. Once America entered it, there was a great surge of patriotic fervor. An awful lot of people enlisted, and even people who were drafted were excited to be over there and to be a part of this war that had swept through the world and was the biggest thing anybody had seen in a very long time. Bordellos, all I have to say is quite possibly they were very popular in France.
Yeah, you're right about the dancing girls and the girls upstairs in World War One. Something else Nevin talked about, he said his grandfather didn't want to talk about the combat stories, the drinking songs and the fun in France and so forth. I took the occasion many years ago to put a microphone in front of my father-in-law who fought in World War II. And I had the same experience that you had, Nevin. He liked to tell the stories, about meeting people and, the fun stories. But I had a really hard time pulling combat stories out of him. And he saw some dreadful stuff, too. I wonder, Richard, how hard it was for you to pull combat stories out of these centenarians that you interviewed for this book.
Honestly, it was not very hard at all. I think I benefited, frankly, from the fact that I got to these men and women as late as I did. I think maybe if I had approached them 20 or 30 years earlier, they wouldn't have wanted to talk about it. But I think the fact that they had lived so long, and they all knew, I think, how remarkable that was, I believe they regarded their memories as something that they didn't want to take with them. They wanted to pass them on to somebody. And I was that person, fortunately. I came along at just the right time. I was very lucky. A lot of them bequeathed their memories to me. Even so, I mean, it wasn't easy necessarily always getting their memories out of them. As I mentioned earlier, I visited with J. Lawrence Moffatt twice. The first time I asked him if he'd ever seen anybody killed in action, and he said no. And I went back and saw him about 3.5 months later. It was actually Veterans Day 2003, and I wanted to see him because he rode in the Veterans Day parade in Orleans, Massachusetts every year. And by that time, I'd interviewed quite a few other people. And I asked him again, I said, did you ever see anybody killed? And this time he said, yeah. One time we were moving from one place to another and I saw a man fall and I went over and rolled him over to tell him to get up and his face was all mutilated and he was dead. And I'm quite sure he remembered that story the first time I visited him too. But for whatever reason, he didn't want to bring it up. And he brought it up the second time. So, you know, sometimes it took some pressing to get the stories out of folks. But in a lot of cases, they were actually more than willing to share. They were eager.
It's interesting what you say, though, that if you had approached them, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, they might not have been so ready and willing.
No, I think that's really the case. But I also think that they got used to not talking about it. You know, a lot of them would tell me that they would stop in the middle of a story and marvel that they were telling me something they hadn't told anybody in 60 or 70 years.
Wow.
And I would ask them why not. And sometimes the answer was that nobody had asked. And that was really surprising to me. But I guess, you know, we all know that people don't like to talk about things like this and they don't want to bring them up. Probably one of the most dramatic moments in the course of doing all these interviews was when I was talking to a gentleman named George Bryant, who had served in an artillery unit down in you know, in France. He was from Louisiana originally, and I interviewed him. His wife was present too. He was 103. His wife was 101. They'd been married for 83 years at that time. And while I'm interviewing him, he's telling me these terribly dramatic stories. And at one point, he actually got quite emotional. And his wife started to scream to stop. This was terrible, what I was doing. She actually called it a mortal sin. And but he became very invigorated by telling these stories. And really, you know, he had a moment where he broke down and cried for a couple of minutes. And then it stopped as suddenly as it started. And he was better than he had been all day. So I think for some of them, it was good for them to sort of hand these memories off to somebody else.
Wow. Well, Nevin, thanks a lot for that call. And let's take another one. This is Gary in Stratham. Hi, Gary. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've really been enjoying the conversation. And my question has to do with how World War I has been somewhat forgotten, as you pointed out, in this country compared to World War II. And I'm wondering if some of that has to do with sort of the dramatic narrative of World War II. If you think of what happened with the campaign in North Africa, D-Day, the liberation of Paris, and everything else that happened, and equally dramatic and you know, very concise in the Western Pacific theater. And I'm wondering if that's just a lot more interesting than trench warfare to a lot of readers.
It just kind of dragged on and on and on. You couldn't see the benefits as dramatically. It's an interesting point, Gary. Thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Richard?
Well, that is an interesting point. I would disagree that the narrative of World War II is more interesting or more dramatic than the narrative of World War I. Actually, a lot of the fighting that Americans did in France did not involve trench warfare, like that last great battle in Meuse-Argonne, or the battle that came before that called Saint-Mihiel, or the battle that came before that in the summer of 1918, the Second Battle of the Marne. There was a lot of movement. I think what's more dramatic is the story of how the war started. I mean, you can't get much more dramatic than Pearl Harbor and the nature of the enemy. You know, I mean, the Nazis represented metaphysical evil to a lot of people. An interesting thing that I discovered in the course of interviewing these World War I veterans is that they didn't particularly hate the Germans or even dislike them. And oftentimes, when they would take German prisoners, they would discover that that the Germans had spent a lot of time in America working before World War I. Arthur Guyempi tells a story of a German prisoner who addresses him in perfect unaccented English and tells him that he lived and worked in Coney Island for 6 years before the war and knew Brooklyn better than he did. There was actually, in a lot of ways, a grudging respect for the enemy in World War I that you didn't have in World War II.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. And a couple of emails have come in as well. The email address, exchange@nhpr.org. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Just a couple memories from our listeners. Amy in Portsmouth. My grandfather was born to Irish immigrants and passed in 1986. He served in the war. He was stationed in Panama in 1918. He was a percussionist in an army band. He used to joke that during the war he was stationed where the bullets were the heaviest. That was because he was at an ammunition manufacturing facility of some sort. That's great, Amy. Thank you for that one. And here's another memory from Mary in Hancock. Her father was a pilot in World War I. He didn't get his orders to go overseas until the day before the armistice. He said the biplanes they flew fired machine gun bullets between the propeller blades, and if they weren't properly synchronized, the plane crashed. Mary says, please tell us about this Air Corps. I don't know if you can get that specific with us, Richard, but there were some interesting differences between the roles that the different armed services played.
It's true. One of the big differences is that the Navy essentially had their war stolen out from under them. When America first entered the war, because unrestricted submarine warfare was such a great part of the reason we entered the war, a lot of Americans assumed that the brunt of the fighting was going to be done by the Navy. And so a lot of young men who wanted action joined the Navy. But quickly, the British and French told Americans, no, 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 what we need are warm bodies in the trenches. And so the burden of fighting the war shifted to the Army, and the Navy, as I put it in the book, had their war stolen out right from under them. But they did a remarkable job. The American Navy did not lose a single troop transport in the course of World War I, which is one of the most remarkable statistics I've ever encountered. I interviewed a couple of Marines as well. They had a very important role in the book. Aviators get a lot of the attention in World War I because they're so dashing and those planes were so cool.
Yeah, those open planes and the scarf flying in the air.
I love them, but there were not very many of them, and unfortunately, I didn't get to speak to any. Although I did interview a gentleman who started out the war in what was called the Balloon Corps. Those were hot air balloons that floated up 50, 100 feet off the ground for observation purposes, and that was probably about the most dangerous job in the whole American Expeditionary Force because they were completely undefended.
Sure, talk about being an open target, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're just a sitting duck there, I'm told that enemy planes love to shoot down balloons because they looked beautiful while they were falling.
All right. Well, thanks for those emails and those memories. That's great, Mary and Amy. And to Jean in Richmond. Hi, Jean. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. My father was a Polish immigrant. Came to the United States in 1910, went to Chicago, a huge Polish colony, and went to work for the railroad there, Pennsylvania Railroad. The World War I started in 1914. The Americans got in 1917. He joined the Army to go fight for his new country. And he went to a training and wanted to fight in France, but he never got to France. He was put into the 31st Infantry Division, Company B, and they sent him to Japan, and then on to Vladivostok to fight the Bolsheviks and get the Russians back in the war.
Wow.
They were there for about 1 year, and it was very interesting. And my father was one of the first warriors against communism, and then I followed through with 41 years of the federal government for the CIA.
Well, Gene, what a story. And Richard, this is not an aspect of World War I that I'm thinking a lot of people are familiar with, myself included.
No, they're not. But in fact, I was very, very fortunate. I interviewed the last living veteran of the Siberian intervention. America sent two regiments, the 31st, where that gentleman's father was, and the 27th Infantry Regiments, over to Siberia to fight. They weren't there particularly to fight against the Bolsheviks or the Reds, as they were then known, but really to sort of keep the peace and protect American interests. It was a crazy, chaotic situation. The thing that the veteran I interviewed remembered the most was just how cold it was. He said coffee would freeze while you were drinking it. He was the only person, by the way, I interviewed, because he did see some action over there, and people in his regiment were killed. And he absolutely refused to talk about it. He was the only person in the course of hundreds of hours of conversation that I interviewed who ever said the equivalent of, "I don't want to talk about it."
Yeah. Well, but did that happen then during this World War I era?
It did. Americans started going over there in 1918, and they stayed until 1920.
Wow. Well, Gene, thank you very much for sharing that with us, bringing that to light. Boy, Richard, we could talk forever, but one last question for you. You know, another historian who reviewed this book said, "Richard Rubin has done something that will never be possible for anyone to do again, interview the last World War I veterans who have all since died." That's a pretty profound thing. Nobody is ever going to be able to do what you did again.
Yeah, it sounds really good put that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I guess I feel mostly sadness that these guys and women aren't around anymore for me to talk to, because every once in a while I'll think about some aspect of their story and I'll have another question. And even though I only met most of them for a few hours, I just remember them so clearly that I want to pick up the phone and call them again.
Right. Well, Richard, good luck with the book. And this has been great. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Rubin, author of The Last of the Doughboys. Now, he'll be in Portsmouth this Thursday. You can go to our website, nhpr.org, for more information on that and other appearances by Richard Rubin around New Hampshire. Again, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Meixel and Catherine Muzzy. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.